is Inouye Frey Irrevocable Trust 68029. Before we begin, as you can see, Chief Justice Perry is in Carson City attending to some duties for the court up there and asked me to preside down here because he can't see the clock. So we will proceed this morning. Mr. B, are you ready?
Good morning, each of the esteemed justices on this honorable court. May it please this court, I'd like to reserve at least 3 minutes for my rebuttal following the opposing counsel's arguments.
Okay.
Your Honors, may it please this court, I believe that this case turns on two key issues. First, does the state of Nevada enforce spendthrift provisions in spendthrift trusts when that provision is a material provision of a trust, especially when one of two settlers has died? It is our position, and I believe it is the position of both Nevada statute and all preceding case law, that in fact, no, a material provision of a spendthrift trust cannot be modified after the death of one of two settlers. I believe the second issue that is important in this matter is that when there is an attempt to modify a material provision of a spendthrift trust, the trustee has an affirmative obligation to make every effort to defeat and frustrate any efforts to modify such a provision. The facts of this case are not in dispute. Each of the parties agree that in 2009 there was an attempted modification by Stephen Brock to modify a trust created by Dr. Emil Fry and Doria Fry, a married couple who created a trust that was funded nearly in its entirety through a joint life insurance policy. Upon the death of Doria Fry in 2009, the spendthrift trust, which contained the express language required by NRS 166 to make that trust irrevocable and to make that trust and the provisions therein unmodifiable without the unanimous consent of all settlers, all beneficiaries, and without any attempt to modify a material provision of the trust. As opposing counsel will agree, there is no case law preceding this action that discusses the death of one settler and a surviving settler in an attempt to modify a trust. It simply does not exist in this state or in any state across the country.
Counsel, do we have difficulty at the onset of this because of Mr. Brock's changing positions, since he was the one who brought this matter before the court in the first place to change the terms in his capacity?
Yes, Your Honor, and I certainly understand that question, but I think it's important to recognize that Mr. Brock never had the authority or the capacity to modify the provisions of the trust. The very provisions of the trust require that the trust exist to provide for the health, welfare, and education of the beneficiaries. And so, while Mr. Brock did attempt to modify that trust, that modification was void ab initio. His misunderstanding then of the law and the terms of the trust prevent any argument.
What was his specific misunderstanding, since he was the petitioning party with counsel?
His misunderstanding was the effect of the spendthrift trust, Your Honor. Mr. Brock is not an attorney. He had no understanding that a modification of the spendthrift provision would have resulted in a frustration of the material purpose of the trust. Moreover, there was never consent garnered from each of the beneficiaries, and there was never consent garnered from both settlers. And Nevada law clearly dictates that in order to modify an irrevocable trust, there must be consent of all settlers, all beneficiaries, and if any of the settlers have perished, it cannot frustrate a material purpose of the trust. And so,
Beattie, I have a question for you, Mr. Beattie.
There was no objection to the modification by any of the beneficiaries, correct?
There was no affirmative objection, Your Honor. However, I think this court will agree that a failure to object does not equate to affirmative acceptance or consent to an action. And so in that light, I believe it is clear that there was no valid modification of this trust ever entered. Having failed to affirmatively obtain the consent of each of the parties, which were all readily available, these are Mr. Brock's siblings, these are the respondent's siblings, and Dr. Fry's children. There should have been no problem obtaining the consent of each of these parties. Rather, they simply did not object, and a failure to object does not equate to consent. And as a result, that modification remains void ab initio.
And so, so we are to give no effect to the court's role in this?
Your Honor, I think that it's important to note that the court did not ever consider whether or not the spendthrift provision was a material purpose of the trust. And having failed to consider whether or not it was a material provision of the trust, it erred in its duties to this court and to...
There was no appeal taken, there was no challenge, was notice given to all of the beneficiaries of the petition?
Notice was provided to all the beneficiaries of the trust.
And no one filed an objection?
No one
contested it?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, again, a mere lack of objection is not equivalent to consent. Consent requires an affirmative action. And there was no affirmative action taken by any of these parties to object or to consent to the modification of this trust. Moreover, the 2010 modification did not notice any of the other beneficiaries of this trust, nor did they obtain the consent thereof. And so, as a result, having failed to obtain the consent in the 2009 action, having failed to obtain the consent in the 2010 action, there is no question that each of those modifications were void from the beginning.
What is some insight off that 2010 issue? Just a little bit. It's somewhat bothersome to me that the appellant had agreed to settle several lawsuits, and in doing so, essentially pledged his share of the 1996 trust, the security for the payment of his obligations that. He had agreed to.
I don't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. However, with respect, there's no question Mr. Brock certainly has an outstanding debt to the respondents. We don't object to that proposition. What we do object to is the violation of the terms of the trust and the intent of Adoria Fry to create for her children a spendthrift trust maintained for their benefit, welfare, education, and maintenance. Adoria Fry was an equal contributor to the corpus of the trust, and she was an equal settler in the corpus of the trust. And so what respondents are asking this court to do is to acknowledge that there's more or less a race to the grave to determine who gets to control the corpus of the trust after one of the parties dies. And simply put, Nevada law does not support that proposition. There's no state in the union that supports that proposition. In fact, when a settlor dies, the testamentary instrument which they have left behind to dispose of their assets, in this case, the trust at issue, is the only tool, the only instrument which can be used to affect their will and their intent. And here, Adoria Fry intended to provide each and every one of her five children and her five stepchildren a way for them to maintain their life, to have their health benefit, welfare, and education provided for. And through the modification of the 2010 trust, the modification in 2010 and the 2009 modification, each of those modifications frustrated that intent. And regardless of Mr. Brock's actions, her intent.
Frustrate the intent. Under the restatement, in the absence of consent, there is an examination of the question of whether anybody's been prejudiced. None of the other beneficiaries are prejudiced by the modification that was made.
Your Honor, however...
Would you agree?
Your Honor, I can't speak as to whether or not any of the other beneficiaries were prejudiced. They did not participate in either the 2009 or the 2010.
Nobody's challenged it.
No, but Your Honor, they've received
their beneficial distributions.
And in fact, they've received a windfall as a result of the frustration of the intent of the settler. Your Honor, they're not claiming any objection.
They don't seem to be prejudiced. They got the full amount of their beneficial distribution.
They did receive the full benefit of the distribution, Your Honor. However, I think it's important to note.
So why shouldn't this court look at the guidance offered by the restatement of trust second or third, where the modifications of irrevocable trust can be made, even in the absence of the consent of the beneficiaries, unless prejudice is shown? What's wrong with adopting that rule?
Your Honor, I think the problem with adopting that rule is that it would allow for the material frustration of the purpose of a trust. And in fact, if a spendthrift provision exists in a trust, it exists to prevent individuals like Mr. Brock from taking the actions that he took in this specific instance. A spendthrift provision.
Well, that sounds like you want this court to adopt a rule that relieves the scoundrel of his own misdeeds.
In fact, Your Honor, I think I'm asking this court to adopt the rule that was already codified in the statute in NRS 166. And by that, I mean that NRS 166 provides for spendthrift provisions to prevent debtors who are the beneficiaries of spendthrift provisions from pledging their interest in a trust which contains a spendthrift provision to a creditor. And here in this action, when the settlement in 2010 was made, Dr. Fry was not acting in his capacity as a settler. He was not able to give consent on behalf of both settlers. And as such, the modification was null and void. A spendthrift provision must be allowed.
I hate to interrupt you, Mr. Beatty, but before Eldora passed away, the two of them made Stephen their attorney, in fact. Isn't that correct?
In certain instances, but not entirely, Your Honor.
Well, there's a very specific expression of the extent of his powers as attorney, in fact. And the other point I wanted to make, or the question I had for you, is during the settlement in 2010 of his various lawsuits, he was represented by counsel, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And as the settlement was made, that was put on the record and there was a canvass by the judge, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And...
However, to that end, Your Honor, I think it's important to know that there was no consideration of the spendthrift provision discussed in that settlement, any of the settlement documents, any of the actions taken before any of these courts. That spendthrift provision was wholly ignored, and that being a material provision of this trust, it cannot be frustrated after the death of one of the settlers. To allow for the frustration of the material purpose of the trust would take all of the power out of NRS 166 altogether. If all it takes to defeat a material provision of a spendthrift trust is to simply go before a court and make the affirmative statement that they believe that they should not be bound by this spendthrift provision, then there is no power in a spendthrift provision whatsoever. It is merely superfluous language. And so I would ask this court to reject the settlements that was made in 2010. I would ask this court to nullify the 2009 amendment. I would ask this court to require that the respondent return all of the money that was distributed unlawfully from the trust, which was Mr. Brock's beneficial interest in this trust.
Why shouldn't judicial estoppel preclude Stephen from arguing that the 2010 settlement couldn't modify the trust?
Because one of the components of judicial estoppel is whether or not the action was taken under mistake. And quite clearly there was a mistake here, because Mr. Brock was mistaken as to his belief as to whether or not he had the right or the ability to pledge his interest in the 2010 trust. It was not until 2014 when he obtained new counsel, Mr. Daniel Goodsell, that he discovered that he was never legally able to pledge his interest in the trust in the 2010 amendment. And as a result, there was no intention to defraud the court. There was no intention to mislead the court or take some extrajudicial advantage through that settlement. This was clearly a mistake, and judicial estoppel is defeated when mistake is present. And as my closing remark, I'd just like to point this court to NRS 166.120, subsection 4, which requires that the trustee of a spendthrift trust must take every action to defeat the modification of a spendthrift trust, even in the face of a court order, and it took no action here to defeat the modification of material provisions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Gerard, I'll give you 17 minutes. Counsel ran over. He'll have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Chief Justice Perry-Gerry and fellow justices, may it please the court, this case is about the application of judicial estoppel and whether this court should adopt a variation of the position set forth in the Restatement of Trust, Second and Third, and the Uniform Trust Code, which recognize the important public policy of allowing irrevocable trust to be modified to address the needs of the settlors of an irrevocable trust that can change over time due to unexpected circumstances. It's important to note in this case that Judge Sturman, the district court judge that decided this case, made her decision based upon principles of equity and the unique circumstances that were found in this case. She recognized that there is no controlling law on this issue in Nevada at the present time. In this case, we have two parents, Dr. and Mrs. Fry, that set up an irrevocable life insurance trust for the benefit of their combined 10 children. The stated intent of the settlers and a finding expressly made, a factual finding by Judge Sturman, was that the intent of the trust was to treat each of their children equally. The material purpose of the trust was to provide an increased amount of inheritance to the 10 children by avoiding income taxes and estate taxes. We find that stated material purpose in the affidavit that's attached to the petition in 2009 that Stephen Brock submitted to effect the first modification of this irrevocable trust. There's a verified petition signed by Mr. Brock. There's an affidavit of Mr. Brock. And there is an affidavit of Dr. Fry. And all three of those things clearly state that the material purpose of the trust was to pass life insurance proceeds the maximum possible to all the 10 children equally. And to avoid taxes. There's no mention of any material purpose being the spendthrift provision. In fact, the affidavit of Dr. Fry that was attached to that first petition that Stephen Brock filed with the court specifically said that it was a 100-page trust that he had skimmed and that he didn't understand most of the language that was in the trust. Where do we find the spendthrift provision that they claim to be a material provision of the trust? In this 107-page trust, it contains over 50 pages of specific language tailored to the needs of the settlers in this case. We find the six lines that makes up the spendthrift provision, less than one-fifth of one page, at the very end of the trust, in a section entitled Article 13, Definitions and General Provisions, which includes seven pages of boilerplate provisions at the end of the trust. We know that this was not a material provision of the trust. That's evident not only by the affidavits of Dr. Fry and the statements made by Mr. Brock that he's now judicially estopped from changing. But we also know it wasn't a material purpose because of the effect of the 2009 amendment. What happened in the 2009 amendment? The tenets that support a spendthrift provision are that the beneficiary does not have direct access to the funds. In other words, they cannot make a demand that the funds in the trust be released. If they have the right to make a demand that has to be honored, then creditors have the right to go after that money. And what happened in the 2009 amendment was a modification of that exact tenet of spendthrift provisions. The 2009 modification, requested by Stephen Brock under the exact same circumstances that existed at the time of the 2010 amendment as a result of the settlement. In other words, Mrs. Fry had already passed away. Not all the beneficiaries consented, but those that were affected by the modification consented. So under the exact same circumstances that existed in 2009, Mr. Brock asked the court to approve a modification of this irrevocable trust that removed that tenant so that any beneficiary could make a demand to the trustee, and the trustee was required to immediately disperse that beneficiary's share of the trust. That removed, at that time, the tenant, a basic tenant of the spendthrift provision, and destroyed it. If the spendthrift trust provision, was a material purpose of the trust, do you really think that Dr. Fry would have gone along with that at that time? And why would he have supported that amendment? It's obvious from Dr. Fry's own affidavit in support of the 2009 modification, and Mr. Brock's position stated in the verified complaint petition, as well as the affidavit, that it's not a material provision. What we have is a situation where, 5 years after entering into a binding settlement agreement, not once, but twice, orally on the record before Judge Kenneth Corey and a second time before the probate commissioner, Wesley Yamashita, that eventually became an order of the probate judge, Judge Sturman. And after Dr. Fry and the other beneficiaries of the Fry estate and two judges relied upon the settlement and the pledge of Stephen's interest in this irrevocable life insurance trust to ensure that the settlement was paid. And in reliance thereon, they dismissed four different lawsuits, all the claims against Stephen that have been raised in four different lawsuits. And all those claims were dismissed with prejudice in reliance upon the settlement. And Stephen now seeks to be relieved of those settlement obligations, relying on a spendthrift provision, which has already been modified at his request. It just is beyond the pale to think that judicial estoppel would not apply in this case.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Girard. He's claiming that he was mistaken, or he was under a mistaken impression, and that therefore defeats the argument with regard to judicial estoppel. Can you address that, please?
Certainly. We know that the final element of the five elements that are listed in our Nevada Supreme Court's decision of Marcus versus Delaware Communities for judicial estoppel, that the fifth element is that the original position taken in a court was not taken as a result of fraud or mistake. But we also have subsequent cases by this court, including the Brilliant versus Preferred Equities case, in which it's made clear that the fifth element of judicial estoppel is for mistakes of fact only, not a mistake of law. You can't argue that Mr. Brock didn't understand what the law was at that time. He was, number one, represented by very competent counsel at the time that settlement was entered into. He was represented by Dana Dwiggins, who does estate and trust work for a living.
I have a question, and Justice Perry and I were speaking over one another. what if the litigation in 2010 that was settled had been between Mr. Brock and someone other than the settlor, but they nonetheless settled it on the record and pledged his interest in this trust? Would that change your argument with respect to the propriety of judicial estoppel as a doctrine that would bar him from taking a different position now with respect to the spendthrift provisions in that trust?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because the position that he took is exactly the same, and under your hypothetical, would be exactly the same as it is now. Just removing the settlor from the equation as a part of one of the participants of the settlement isn't really relevant if the settlor still consented to the earlier modification, which you didn't put that in your hypothetical.
I didn't, no.
But certainly I think that would be an important factor, whether the settlor consented. In this case, of course, we don't have that.
What you're saying is the judicial estoppel arises out of the 2009 amendment
2010 settlement doesn't have anything to do with it.
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I think the estoppel arises from both of those modifications. I think that the position that he took in 2009 in his petition and the position that he took in the 2010 second modification affected through the settlement both prevent and stop him from making the arguments that are being made in this case. Because in both of those situations, they did the same. They did exactly what they're now claiming can't be done.
Let's modify this. Let's take the 2009 issue off the table. Let's say we have a plain spendthrift trust, and then you have litigation with one of the beneficiaries who enters into a settlement to pledge his interest. You're not saying that that in and of itself would give rise to judicial estoppel, or are you?
I'm saying that the factors in the 2010 settlement are exactly the same as the factors in the 2009 settlement. So the fact that you take that off the table doesn't really change the judicial estoppel argument. Because in 2010, he still took a position that's inconsistent with the one that he's now taken 5 years later, and he did it in a court, and he did it under oath, and he did it in a situation that would satisfy each of the five factors that we have for judicial estoppel. So although I think it strengthens considerably the judicial estoppel argument that the 2009 petition was filed and what happened, I don't think that we have to rely simply on the 2009 petition. Even the 2010 settlement affected a modification. And that's a finding of fact.
Yeah, I guess the problem I have with, I think the 2009 and 2010 work together, because if you just had the 2010 one and it were a creditor other than the settlor, that would really fly in the face of the protections that a spendthrift trust provision is trying to create. So you need the settlor, at least the surviving settlor's consent to it, I think, for your position to work.
I don't disagree that strengthens it considerably, and I understand the distinction Your Honor is drawing. Fortunately, in this case, we don't have that issue.
Right, we have to write an opinion or an order.
I understand that. But if you look at the positions that have been adopted by the restatement that relate to this, it's interesting that the restatement, as Justice Hardesty alluded to earlier, and in particular, section, grab my notes here, 338 of the second restatement, permits an irrevocable trust, even if it has a spendthrift provision, which is identified in comment H to section 338, to be modified without the consent of all the beneficiaries, as long as there's no prejudice to the beneficiaries that don't consent. And here,
is there theoretical prejudice in the alleviation of the spendthrift provision as to the beneficiaries who can claim immediate distributions?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Legal prejudice. I mean, they welcomed their distributions after Dr. Fry passed.
Correct.
And so they elected to take them.
Correct. But which they wouldn't have been able to do but for the first modification.
Right. So did the first modification, though, work to their legal prejudice because it removed their immunity from creditors' reach, theoretically?
Well, obviously, they all had notice of the first modification. It was notice to all beneficiaries, and none of them objected. So I don't know that we need to go there, because I don't know that legally, as a matter of law in Nevada, contrary to what counsel just said, if they're noticed and they have the opportunity to object and they don't, then that their lack of objection can be taken as consent. So the point here is that we don't have to get that far, but I think what the restatement is trying to do is to provide flexibility, particularly for unanticipated circumstances. In fact, you know, there's another restatement section that follows the ones that we've been addressing that has what they refer to as the unanticipated circumstance rule, where a court on its own can modify a trust because of unanticipated circumstances, and it doesn't even take into account whether the settlor consents or the beneficiary's consent. And I would point out that the restatement, there's nothing in the restatement that says that it doesn't apply if one of two settlers have passed away. Now, they've made a big issue out of that in this case, and we understand why. It's a factual thing that they can hopefully try to argue. But there's nothing in the restatement or any of the cases that have followed the restatement that addresses that issue and says, in the absence of one settler, of the original two settlers, that the trust can't be modified, no matter what the changed circumstances are, and no matter what the other equities are that come to bear.
How do you write an opinion that, excuse me, Justice Douglas, did you want to ask first?
Just changing up a little bit. In the back part of the argument that was presented, they put a duty on Premier to A, not pay, and B, to assert that the SPIN-BIF-RIF trust should not have been, in essence, abated.
Right.
What's your position on that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we should follow, with respect to that, the restatement second, at section 216, which basically says that if the trustee takes action reasonably and in good faith on the basis of the consent of the beneficiaries, but it turns out that the action was contrary to a material purpose, or that all the beneficiaries that needed to consent didn't consent, the consenting beneficiaries cannot hold the trustee liable for any breach of any duties because they did give their consent. And that's the restatement view, and I think it's a good view. I mean, in this case, Premier Trust was acting in reliance upon not just one court order, but two court orders, and the understanding of everybody that was involved that Stephen Brock had pledged his interest in this trust through a modification effected by a settlement. And they followed that. Suddenly, 5 years after it happened, we have this objection that's raised, which we think, you know, flies in the face of estoppel, but nonetheless, they were acting in good faith based upon what they understood from court orders that they had the right to rely upon. So, in this case, Justices, we believe that to the extent that the court is going to write new law in the state of Nevada, I think that the one overriding factor that should be taken into consideration by the court is that there are going to be situations where circumstances change that cannot be anticipated. Do you really think that Dr. Fry could have anticipated that Stephen Brock, one of the beneficiaries who was supposed to be treated equally with all others, was going to steal nearly $1 million worth of assets, and he was going to have to sue him to get that money back so that he and his wife's intent to treat all their children equally wouldn't be frustrated? He didn't have the ability, nor did his wife, to anticipate that that was going to happen. And when unforeseen circumstances like that arise, there needs to be flexibility to modify an irrevocable trust. And the restatement view recognizes that, and that's why we think that we should go down that path in the state of Nevada, and that we should recognize that that right does exist so that the court knows what parameters and under what circumstances they could make such a change.
If we don't find judicial estoppel, can you still prevail in this matter?
Sure. Under the restatement view, if the court is to adopt that, we definitely can. You know, Justice Hardesty kind of went down that path earlier in his questions to opposing counsel, but the restatement view clearly allows you have a modification like we have in this situation. You've got one settler that's consented, you have all the beneficiaries who are affected, whose interest would be prejudiced, have consented, and that's enough under the restatement. And there's good public policy reasons behind that. You know, you don't want to bind the hands of the subsequent trustee and or the settler to the extent that there's a problem. You know, we cited a...
actions that have... adopted the restatement positions.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Do you know of any other jurisdictions that have adopted the restatement positions?
We have cited some in our brief. I don't recall what they are off the top of my head, but we cited some jurisdictions that have followed the restatement view, and of course, restatement itself has cases at the end of the restatement that show those jurisdictions that have followed that. But we have seen that this position, which is also a position of the Uniform Trust Code, has been adopted in the majority of states. That's stated right in the restatement and in the Uniform Trust Code.
I have an additional question for you as it relates to whether the court should entertain the restatement approach. Prior to the 2009 amendment, this trust was set up where the grandchildren were contingent beneficiaries, but actually the contingency, they were actually beneficiaries in 2009, not contingent. The children of Adori, as an example, were not entitled to receive a distribution, only income, correct?
Under certain circumstances, they you could go beyond that, but as a general rule, I agree.
All right. So what if the dispute here was raised by one of the children of the children of Adoria, the grandchildren, objecting to this modification? especially in the context of a spendthrift trust. Once Doria dies, that trust is fixed with respect to her children and fixed with respect to her, the grandchildren or the children of those children. I'm a bit concerned that Section 338 may be overread in terms of the consent requirements or the prejudice issues that would derive from an amendment of a irrevocable spendthrift trust in that context.
And the response that I have to that is based upon Dr. Frye's affidavit that was attached to the 2009 petition to amend. Dr. Frye stated in that affidavit that prior to his wife's surgery, he and she had several discussions regarding the trust, and that while she was no longer competent to make an affidavit at the time he signed that, which was December of 2008, that she was still alive at that time, that he knew that her intent was the same as his, and he stated that his primary objective with the trust was to provide for their children, not the grandchildren. And then he went on to explain that the trust had a lot of provisions in it that he didn't really understand. It was very lengthy, and he didn't recognize at the time that he signed it that that was what was intended. That's what the language was saying. So that's one of the reasons why he went along with the 2009 amendment, was because he stated right in his affidavit that his intention was that if the children, that the money was for the children, and if they wanted to keep some of it into the trust so that their grandchildren could use it later on, that would be up to each one of the children. So that's exactly why I think that the restatement approach should be followed, for exactly that sort of circumstance, where the settlor clearly didn't intend that to be the case. Yet that's what was written in the trust by the attorneys, and he didn't understand that that's what it was until it was brought to his attention. And then he asked that that be modified because he wanted the distributions to go to the children unless the children decided that they wanted to leave it in the trust for their grandchildren. So in the circumstances of this case, that's the response. I don't know that that's a general response because it's related to this specific case.
It does call into question, though, what are the rights of the grandchildren with respect to the 2009 modification?
Well, that argument...
Are they beneficiaries who should have consented?
I don't know that they are, given the language of the trust. It did provide for some potential distributions to be made to grandchildren, but we don't know whether it would have ever gone.
Were they the ultimate beneficiaries before the 2009 amendment?
Depends. It depends on how much money was distributed from the trust prior to those grandchildren having a right to any of it. So they're not actual beneficiaries, they're contingent beneficiaries. But
the contingency is based upon the assets of the trust, not based upon an election after the 2009 amendment was enacted by a vested beneficiary versus a contingent beneficiary.
I don't disagree that in an abundance of caution, you know, perhaps bringing them in at that point, you know, providing all of them notice, although many of them, you know, wouldn't have the legal authority to do anything with it anyway, minors. But I understand the distinction. I understand that it's a potential issue. As I pointed out, though, that's exactly why, you know, Section 66 of the Restatement Second exists for unanticipated circumstances where that wasn't anticipated by the settlers.
Counsel, should we be concerned at all? I mean, what we seem to have is a collateral attack on judgments that were never appealed, saying that they're now void ab initio. Should we be concerned?
Well, I think we should be very concerned. I raised that in our brief. I mean, obviously, if they wanted to overturn the orders that were entered by Judge Corey on his record and by Judge Yamashita and eventually by Judge Sturman back in 2009, there are methods to do that. Under Rule 59 of the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, you have 10 days, right, to amend. Under Rule 60B, you have 6 months to obtain relief from an order. Nothing was done within that time frame, and it's too late to do that now. Even if, as a last case scenario, they could have filed a petition under the probate section of the Nevada Revised Statutes and at least asked the court to consider whether that was binding or not. But they didn't do that either. What they did is allowed everybody to rely upon these orders for more than 5 years and then try to challenge it when it came time to pay the piper. I took a little exception to the comment that there was a windfall. I don't know that repaying an obligation and a debt for money that you misappropriated would ever be considered a windfall. I think what it is it's trying to affect the intent of these settlers to treat all their children equally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any further questions? Chief, any additional questions?
No, thank you. I'm good.
All right.
Thank you, Justice.
Go ahead, Mr. Beattie. You have 3 minutes.
Your Honors, as a preliminary matter, I'd like to point out that opposing counsel is asking this court to adopt the second restatement and the Uniform Trust Code over the codified statute NRS 166. And I believe that to be an invasion of the legislative powers of the state of Nevada. And as a result, I think this court is obligated to follow the provisions of NRS 166.
Counsel, as you say that, back to the same question I asked him. Why should we allow this collateral attack unless you have some authority about your void ab initio position? Because it was never, those orders were not set aside, the mayor relied upon them.
Well, Your Honor, to answer that question, I think it's important to note, as we pointed out in our reply brief, that in the 2014-2015 action, the order from that we are now discussing on appeal, there was no argument raised, no question raised as to whether or not a challenge was appropriate or time barred at that time.
Well, a challenge appropriate is your part of the proper party to bring the challenge based upon what Justice Hardesty was talking about, grandchildren and so on. This is the party who asked the court to make the change.
It is, Your Honor. However, that being said, having there been no challenge at the district court level to these actions, that argument cannot be relied upon here. But as the other justices have pointed out, the contemplated beneficiaries, the prospective beneficiaries, were never.
They're not before this court. Or does it seem, based upon our record, that you attempted to bring them into the action below?
And for that very reason, Your Honor, I think it's important to note that no consent was obtained from those parties. No notice was given to those parties. And so, as a result,
was notice given to them in the original proceedings to make the change?
It was not, Your Honor.
Brought by your client.
Respectfully, it was not, Your Honor. There was no notice given to them. And as a result, if the action was void ab initio, then...
In 2009, you're saying there was no notice given to the other beneficiaries?
To the prospective beneficiaries, Your Honor, the grandchildren.
Okay, but to the immediate 10 children, notice was given.
That's my understanding, is that notice was given, no affirmative consent was provided, and they didn't participate in that action. Moreover, none of the other beneficiaries participated in the 2010 action. Now, I do take issue with the statements made by opposing counsel as to Mr. Brock's actions. There was no judicial finding of any wrongdoing on his part, but that's not really particularly relevant to this action. What is relevant is that, as a very threshold issue, a modification that affects the material purpose of the trust must involve the consent of the settlers and all beneficiaries. And if any settler is incapacitated at the time of modification, then it is void ab initio. And here, as opposing counsel just stated, when the affidavit was made by Dr. Fry, Adoria Fry was incapacitated, unable to provide her consent to any modification. Moreover, that is based on hearsay and completely inadmissible. And so I would suggest that there was never consent from Doria Fry, either prior or after her death.
Power of attorney.
Power of attorney on behalf
Mr. Brock had on behalf of Adoria?
Yes, but not as to the terms of the trust, as I understand it. So, Your Honors, I think that the threshold issue here is that there was no consent obtained from Adoria Fry without her consent. And after her death, there's no possibility for the modification of this trust. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, counsel, for your briefing and your arguments today. The case will